Apologetics, Matt Slick Live. Matt is the founder and president of the Christian Apologetics Research Ministry, found online at carm.org. When you have questions about Bible doctrines, turn to Matt Slick Live for answers. Taking your calls and responding to your questions at 877-207-2276. Here's Matt Slick.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. It's me, Matt Slick, and you're listening to Matt Slick Live, and I hope you are all having a good day, and you had a good resurrection weekend. It was really good stuff. And if you want, you can give me a call today. All you have to do is dial 877-207-2276, and I want to hear from you. Give me a call, and we can talk. Now, today is April 1st. No jokes coming forth. And I'm not going to play any games with that. I don't know. I'm being too old for it. I don't know. But at any rate, hey, look, I want to hear from you. We have nobody waiting right now. You can give me a call. If this is the first time you're listening, then I'm a Christian apologist, which means I defend the Christian faith. In fact, I was on Discord this morning, and I was a couple hours. I was talking about Islam with some people doing that. And so I had a good time there. Then had to go run errands. Okay, so it was really great. And if you want to call me, like I said, 877-207-2276. Okay, now, here we go, getting that set right there. All right, good. You know, so I'm working on this article on the term Son of Man. And I went and I looked, it's not released yet, I went and I looked at every instance of it in the entire Bible, and it occurs, I don't know how many times this occurs, 100 and some odd times, and 70, in fact, what was interesting is it occurs, I think it was 88 times in the New Testament, 77 of them are when Jesus refers to himself that way, which I thought was really interesting, and then it occurs in the Old Testament, but in the Old Testament, it's always in reference to just people. Except in Ezekiel, it's in reference to Ezekiel, the individual. And in Daniel 7, 13, and 14, it's in reference to the pre-incarnate Christ. And I enjoyed that. I'm going through, and I am listing out just the phrase that Jesus was talking about himself and the things related to what he said about himself, as he says, the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. You know, well, that, you know, he has no place to lay his head, okay? He's a vagabond kind of thing. And the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Oh, so he's Lord of the Sabbath. You know, so just writing all these things down and developing an article on that, and hopefully it'll release in a couple of days. So doing that kind of stuff. And also, I had to run an errand today and got to talk to someone, a worker, an employee at a place, and I won't say her name, but if you're going to pray for her. She's the one who hurt her hand, and she knows Mormonism is false, and she wants to know what the truth is. So I gave her my contact information, and hopefully she and I will be able to talk, and I said, you can come over to the house with my wife there. I said, I won't meet you alone any place, but, you know, unless it's out in public, but I said, I can give you information if you want, or whatever, you know, I mean, because she was really curious and really interested in the dialogue. So I said, okay, good. And there we go. Now, okay, producer Keith, are we having problems with the phone line? Because I have a new gateway, a new internet connection, which everything should be up to date, everything should be fine, and that's why I'm asking if we're having any problems there, because it came in, and can you hear me? You can't hear me there, huh? No radio, no audio. We'll figure that out. Okay. Everything looks fine on the settings. Yeah, that's good there. Should be working. And make sure everything's good there. But you know what? We did have a bit of a catastrophe in that my cat... you know how cats are. So, I don't know if I have sound inside of Rumble, but my cat gets on the desk. Now, he's a purebred Russian Maine Coon. He was given to us. That's another story. And he's just, we call him Flopper because he's just huge. He's 20 pounds, and he's still growing. And he just gets onto things, and things fall off because he's big. And so he knocked over, oh, you can hear me now? Good. He knocked over the sound box that I have on my desk that I use for part of this work. And I go, I don't know if it's broken or anything, but I guess it's okay. He says, you hear me? That's all right. So there we go. All right. Let's get to Spencer from North Carolina. Spencer, welcome. You're on the air.
How you doing today, Matt?
Oh, hanging in there, man. Just hanging in there. Putting out fires and fixing things all the time. So what do you got, buddy?
I heard you one time recently talking about the King James Version of the Bible and that it's there was something in it that you didn't like about that Bible. Is there any other Bible that you would prefer that someone should study, and why?
Yeah, I prefer the NASB, the New American Standard Bible, because it's more literal to the Greek, and it uses better manuscripts, ancient manuscripts, than the King James. The King James was good, and, you know, if people want to use it, that's fine, as long as they know where the problems are in it, like Romans 5:18, Titus 2:13, the Comma Johannium, a few things and a few issues. And most people don't read the original King James. They read a modified, updated version of the King James. They don't realize that the original is very difficult to understand and read. And I have pictures of it on my phone, and because I have some at a friend who has an original page of the first one, and so first edition. So I'll put it up there. But at any rate, so most people just don't know, and it's just the way it is. But the King James is good. But if you want serious study, what I would say is you need to use the NASB and or the ESV. I would say those are pretty good. I think the
are you saying B as in boy or V as in victory?
The NASB, New American Standard Bible. Okay. That's what I use.
Okay. That's awesome. Because I grew up in the King James Version. I didn't know that there was stuff in it that wasn't right or anything like that. That's just what I was raised in. And
it's
I heard
fine.
You speaking about that. I don't want to call her.
Yeah, it's fine. Except, look, the problems, for example, thee and thou, why would you want, this is me, I don't understand this. Why would you want to memorize English from 400 years ago and then speak to modern people quoting it? I could never understand if thou wilt believeth. Like, what? Well, just talk to me in normal English. That's all I, you know. And so, you know, I grew up basically in Southern California, and you didn't do that. You just talked to people normally, and you'd want an updated version so you could quote it normally and naturally. And so that's where I developed that. But, the King James is fine. I mean, if people want to preach out of it and teach, that's fine. As long as they know those places where the translations in the King James weren't as good as they need to be. And I can show you a couple of those if you want. But okay. So not a big deal.
Yeah. When was the new edition, the American Standard, how did they go about translating that from the King James to the American Standard?
They don't translate from the
was
King
there,
James.
Was it?
It's not how
well,
it was done.
Convert it, I guess.
See, how it was done was this. When the King James was done, it used, from what I understand, 5th century documents. So let me explain what's going on. So in the 1st century, they wrote the New Testament. Those documents got copied very carefully, very meticulously. But as is often the case when people are involved, little errors would creep in, like forgetting the word the, which is a single letter in Greek, or reading a line and putting, because they could be tired when they're copying, they could put a word twice, just things like this, okay? And so they might put a marginal note in, a scribe might put a marginal note in something, and then they put this document away, and 200 years later, someone else gets it. So he may have written it in the year 300, and in the year 500, someone finds this manuscript that's been lost, that someone put a marginal note in, and then they see this, and they see the marginal note. Like, what do we do with this? Because they don't know the context. Is it part of the original text? Now, if it's a commentary, they can tell it's not part of the original. But what if, the word Christos, Christ, was put in there in the marginal note? Well, does that mean it belongs in the text, like next to Jesus, which is Jesus? They might put that in there. Well, this 5th century documents like that. Well, the idea generally is that the older the manuscripts, 4th century, 3rd century, 2nd century, the older the manuscripts, the more they are, the closer they are to the original, and therefore they're going to have fewer what they call variants. So the NASB is translated from the Greek into the English, for example, New Testament, from older manuscripts, as is the ESV. Where the King James is done with roughly 5th century documents. That's not exactly accurate, but it's, for the most part it is. It's just a general rule of thumb. And so the older ones are just more accurate. And so what happens is the King James people will say, oh, the modern Bibles, they take stuff out. Well, not necessarily, because the King James could have put stuff in that didn't belong there in the original, because when they find older manuscripts since the King James was written and translated, they find out that these older manuscripts don't have some of the wording that is in the King James manuscripts that they used. So they go, oh, these are, this is older. This was an addition by a scribe. So therefore, they go back and they say, the King James people say, see, they took stuff out. No, it's not how it works. All right, so just so you know, there's 6,000, roughly 6,000 Greek manuscripts of different sizes and different texts of the New Testament. And they are something like 99.85% textually identical. There's only a few places where of textual variation. Okay?
Okay. Was there any books missing?
No.
In the King James Bible that are in the original manuscripts?
Nope. King James did a great job of translating a lot of stuff. Seriously, did a great job. But no, there's no additional books, you know, taken in and out or something like that. But when King James commissioned it, they translated the apocryphal books as well. But the apocryphal books were never considered scripture; they were just important historical documents, and they were also translated. So that's all that's going on. Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Hey, you're welcome, man. No problem at all. All right. God bless.
Hey, have a good night.
Okay.
Yeah, same to you. God bless you.
All right. Well, that was Spencer. Now, let's get to Luke from Washington, D.C. Luke, welcome. You're on the air. Luke. Luke, are you there? I hit the go button. You should be on. Now I'm talking to myself, filling in dead space, so there's no dead air. Luke, might be a bad connection.
Hi.
Hey, there you go.
Hello?
All right. Yeah. Okay.
Hi, Matt Stick. How are you?
I'm fine. Hanging in there. Just answering questions on this first day of April.
It's not a joke. It's a very important question.
Okay.
John 20:31.
Okay. Yes.
What does John 20:31 mean?
Well, it says these things have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. It's pretty simple. The New Testament.
If Jesus is called the Son of God.
Yes, he's the Son of God, yes. Hey, hold on, man. We got a break, okay? Hold on, we got a break. And we'll get to this afterwards. You can formulate your question, and then what we'll do is we'll give it a shot after the break, okay? Hey, folks, if you want to give me a call, 877-207-2276. We'll be right back. Please give me a call.
It's Matt Slick Live, taking your calls at 877-207-2276. Here's Matt Slick.
All right, everyone, welcome back to the show. If you want to give me a call, all you have to do is dial 877-207-2276. You can also email me a comment or question. Just direct your email to info@carm.org, info@carm.org. Just put in the subject line, put in carm question or radio question, radio comment would be fine, and we usually get to them. All right, let's get back on with Luke as soon as Keith reactivates Luke. Yeah, maybe he's panicking right now, running to the thing. Let's get to it. Come on, let's go. Or maybe we can get to Jamal. No, there we go. All right. Okay, Luke. Welcome, buddy. You're back on.
So, yeah, this another verse, whoever confesses that Jesus is the Son of God abides in him and he in God. 1 John 4:15. So, he's Son of God. You know, the Muslims always say Jesus is not a God, Son of God. They use these two verses. So, what is your opinion of a Son of God and Jesus is a God?
Yeah, I was just talking about this with some Muslims in a room, a chat room, earlier today. And I tell them that you must, or they should, understand what the words and the phrases mean in the context.
One second. You can sit here.
It would be better for me to look at the you, health or you
okay.
First.
Oh, did you want to, yeah. Hold on. Okay, we'll have to mute him because there's background noise and stuff. So I tell the Muslims that they must understand what the term means the way it was written, not the way they're saying it means. Because what the Muslims often say, the term Son of God means that God had a consort and that he had relations with her and then produced the offspring. And that they say that's false. I go, well, we agree that's false. That's not our position. And the term Son of God is a term related to the deity of Christ, showing his godness. And so what I'll tell them is that in that context, at that time, it was a claim of equality with God. And the verse that you can go to prove that that is the case is John 5:18, where it says that Jesus was not only breaking the Sabbath, but he really wasn't, because it was in the view of the Jews, but it's another topic, calling God his own Father, making himself equal to God. And so I say in the context of that time and the culture, that's what that phrase meant in relationship to Christ. So that's what I tell them, and with a reactivate Luke here to get him on because I put him on hold because of the background noise. But that's what I tell them, and that they need to understand it according to what the culture says, not what they say, you know, 2,000 years later. Okay?
Do you have any link that you wrote? Did you have any link I can read about it? So I know.
Well, let me check. Let's see. Son of God. Go into Carm and type in the phrase Son of God. And I think I've got an article. Do the Bible and the Quran agree on the terms God and Son of God? And if Jesus is called the Son of God, do you think that makes him God? And can Jesus be both God and the Son of God? Does the term Son of God mean that Jesus is not God? Who is the Son of God? I've got all these articles that I've written, and Luke Wayne also joined in on that one, to write about the term Son of God. So go to Carm, type in the phrase Son of God, and there you go. Okay. All right.
Yeah, there. Always when I go to this, your Calm, I couldn't find out whatever I type. So I don't know what to do. Otherwise, I will not ask you a question like this. I have a hard time to find out some.
Go to Calm, go to the homepage, and you'll see the search thing near the top. And just type in Son of God and hit equal. That's it. And
all
I just
right.
Read you the articles that came up right there. Okay, just did it, and that's what
okay.
Happened. All right.
All right. Thank you, sir.
All right, man. God bless. All right. If you want to give me a call, it's easy. 877-207-2276. Jamal from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Welcome. You're on the air.
Always a pleasure, Matt Slick. Thank you for taking my phone call.
Sure, man. No problem, man.
Wanted to... All right. I wanted to ask what the significance is of the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's it.
The Dead Sea Scrolls were scrolls written probably by the Essenian community. And they wrote before the time of Christ, shortly before, and maybe during. But they wrote... they did a lot of work of copying the Old Testament scrolls and put them in caves. And so I've been to Israel twice, and I've been in the cave, the first cave that they got the first Dead Sea Scroll out. I've been in Cave 1. And in that area, there's a place you can go to look at different caves. And it's an outlook. So there's a lot of caves. All right. So... what happened is that the Essenes, what they did was they copied lots of documents. And one of the most important things is they copied the book of Isaiah. Now, before the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in 1946, I believe it was, or 47, the oldest copy of Isaiah was from the Masoretic Scroll, around, and it was copied right around 900 AD. So that means that compared to now, you know, it's 1,100 years old. All right, so when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, they discovered one of the Isaiah scrolls in there. Well, that they are dated around 100 BC, this one scroll. 100 BC is 1,000 years before the Masoretic Scroll of Isaiah, which is dated around, the copy is around 900. It means it's a 1,000-year difference. 1,000 years. And the reason this is so important is because they found out that the copying method for that 1,000 years was incredibly accurate. The critics didn't even raise any objections because it was so accurately transmitted over 1,000 years. They compared the Masoretic text to the Dead Sea Scroll text of Isaiah, and it's accurate. It's the same. So it's That's very impressive. Significant because of that. Okay?
Okay. All right. I was listening to some preachers on Truth Network say, well, the Dead Sea Scrolls kind of give validity to Jesus Christ and what he was talking about, because if you say, well, Jesus and his followers, they kind of propped up his, I guess, his reverence or his status because they went back and changed things according to the Bible, or Jesus read the Bible and changed. Go ahead.
I'm confused. I'm not following you. So some people are saying that the Bible was changed. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm just not getting it. The Bible was changed?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I guess I could do a better explanation. I'll give you a better explanation. So they were saying people who are trying to discount Jesus in the Bible, and this was Lon Solomon that was saying some of this. So they were saying, well, Jesus was a con artist because he read some parts of the Bible and fashions his own history.
I'm sorry. I'm laughing because to say he was a con artist is just yeah. dumb. It's just dumb.
Yeah,
he's a con artist. Well, okay, well, hold on, because we've got a lot of responses.
All right.
A con artist, oh my goodness. Wow, that's really good. Okay, we'll be right back, folks, after these messages. We'll get back with Jamal, and we'll be discussing this issue. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned.
It's Matt Slick Live, taking your calls at 877-207-2276. Here's Matt Slick.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Let's get back on with Jamal. We're having a little bit of an issue here today. So there we go. All right. So, Jamal, welcome, man. You're on the air.
Thanks for having me back.
All right, so Jesus was a con man.
No, those are not my words, as you probably know by yeah. now. It's just, you know, this is what we have to fight out here, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I've had that kind of stuff said to me before by critics, and I say, okay, explain how he was a con man. Explain how it worked. And while you're doing that, explain how he was born in Bethlehem according to the prophecy, was crucified according to the prophecy, how he walked in or rode in on a donkey according to the prophecy, 172,880 days after the command to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, which is found
right.
in Daniel 9:24-27, and was the command to rebuild was on March 14th, 445 BC, and 172,880 days is when Jesus came in. And don't forget to tell us how he was conned people by saying he was crucified when the Jews knew what he looked like, the Romans knew what he looked like, and then he rose from the dead 3 days later. How is he a con man? How does that work? Please tell us. That'd be interesting
right.
for you to develop a theory that explains all of it as a con man. Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, no. Oh, you're talking about answering them. Yeah, exactly. And I've learned a lot of this by, of course, listening to the show. Then they were saying, well, let's see if I can phrase this correctly. He was first a con artist, and he adapted his life to the Bible. But, you know, you talked about that pretty well, of course. And okay. I think there was the another arc. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, oh, okay. I was going, mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard this before. And people say that, you know, he lied or he cheated. I go, okay, so let's look at the context. So Rome was in military and political control of Israel, but Israel was allowed to have its worship. But Rome had Caesaropapism, which was emperor worship, but they let this little sliver of land and these people over there on the other side of the Mediterranean, and they let them have their little god to serve. That's what the, you know, the Roman attitude was. And the Sanhedrin did not want the balance between the Roman Empire and the people and the power in the land of Israel. They didn't want that messed up. So when little messiahs would come in, others that claimed to be messiah type, to deliver from the oppression of the Romans, they were quickly destroyed. So if it was a con artist, then can you please explain, you know, if he's a con artist or he, you know, fooled people, can you please explain how he got them, the disciples, to give up their livelihood, taking care of their families, and not just one, but a bunch, and
right.
risk their families' lives by doing this, and risk excommunication by the Sanhedrin, and risk the idea of political pressure being brought down by Rome upon the Sanhedrin to stop them from saying Jesus is the Messiah, when in that culture at the time, part of the hope of the Messiah was that he would deliver from the oppressors of the Roman Empire. That's one of the things. The zealots, one theory is the zealots were there to help the Messiah rebel against the Roman Empire. And Judas Iscariot was a zealot, and one theory, just a theory, is that it might have been the case that what Judas was trying to do was force Jesus to act in order to deliver Israel from Rome. I mean, it's just theory, you know. So this is all interesting stuff. So if he's a con man, or if it wasn't true, or he deceived people, then how did he get all these people to join him based on what they said they saw? And that's different than what you hear 1,000 years later. I heard someone talk about this, I'm going to believe it. No, they saw the risen Lord, and it changed their lives. It went all over the place, and they're being killed in the process. And you know that the disciples would hear about other disciples being killed, and yet they continued on. So I asked these people who come up with these theories, I say, could you please explain how all this works together inside of your theory? And they can't. Okay.
And you know, that's something I've told other people. I say, well, get the argument off of you. I heard a guy named Matt Slater say, well, get them to prove their theory. And just watch the wheels turn and the wheels spin and all that. One last one, and I'll get off the phone.
That's
So when you have Jesus, you know, making statements about I am and all that, and all these prophecies being lined up, and about the 500 witnesses, something else that somebody else said, I think it might have been Lee Strobel. And he said, well, or him or somebody else said, well, for all those witnesses, for everything that they saw, like you said, there are no scriptures, there are no documents that say that there were any detractors, anybody of that time saying that, no, all those guys were hallucinating, they were talking falsehoods. You have no documents, to my knowledge, to what I'm hearing.
Right.
You have no documents refuting what the eyewitnesses saw. Is that true?
Right. There's nothing that is counter evidential. Nothing's there. If anything, let's just say that you find a document that said that the followers of this Jesus person were mistaken because he didn't rise from the dead. Let's just say that you find something like that, okay? Well, what does that mean? Well, it means you have a critic, and it means the ancient document talks about Jesus. So there he was. He was real.
Right.
Of course you can have people on both sides. So that just corroborates that he really was there. Now let's explain everything. So even when critics cite things about Jesus later on or whatever, it means that they're referring to a historical figure. Okay?
Exactly. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. Very informational. I appreciate it. And God bless, Matt Slater.
Hey, man. Always appreciate you calling, Jamal. God bless, buddy. All right. All right. Let's get to Dave from North Carolina. Dave, welcome. You're on the air.
Hello. on, Mr. Slick. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. Hanging in there, man. Hanging in there. What do you got?
So, I guess it's two parts to the question, but what is the origin of the Apocrypha? And I've heard that it wasn't added, I guess, to the Bible because it was not God-inspired.
That's correct.
So I'm guessing, like, where does it originate from?
Well, it's was written during the time of Malachi, around 400 BC, and between that and the time of Christ. And I don't know what individuals or groups wrote the apocryphal books. So that's just an interesting question. Hey, I wonder who, you know, if they know any individuals who did it or what. But they are valuable historical documents, but they contain a few errors. And the Jews knew about them, and the Jews never considered them to be scripture. So in the Old Testament, there are many places, like over 20, that quote or reference other books besides the scriptures. The book of the War of the Lords, for example. And so it doesn't mean that that book is inspired. It's a reference, because an inspired writer could go to a book, an ancient book that they had in their ancient library, and find a reference to something and then quote it. And he's quoted it, and that's it. Just like Paul did Epimenides and Menander and Erastus. So these are pagan philosophers. So nevertheless, the apocryphal books were written during the intertestamental period between roughly 400 BC and the time of Christ. But they were not considered to be scripture. But the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church basically added them in the 1500s. Okay, 1546 for the Catholic Church. I don't know when it happened for the Eastern Orthodox Church. And there's a reason for that. But anyway, okay.
Okay. Is there an article or anything I can? Because I don't want to take up a lot of time. But is there an article or a book or something you would recommend to look into more about that?
Sure. If you want, you can go to my website, carm.org. carm.org, and just type in the word in the search engine. Just type in Apocrypha. I just did that. And here's an article I wrote in 2009, Reasons Why the Apocrypha Does Not Belong in the Bible. And the Apocrypha is a scripture. Errors in the Apocrypha. Early church fathers on the Apocrypha. Apocryphal books, Protestant, Catholic, Orthodox, Russian, Coptic. And so, are there lost books of the Bible? Is another article. What is the Catholic Bible? How many books are in the Bible? And so you can see there's lots of articles that address this issue. And you can go check them out. Okay.
Okay. Is there anybody in line right now, or can I ask one more question?
There's nobody else waiting, so hey, it's just you and me right now. And we got a break coming up pretty soon. What do you got?
Oh, sorry. So what, I guess, what stance do Catholics take to, I can't think of how to word it. To approve the Apocrypha being added to the Bible? You know, how do they defend it if it's goes against, you know, like the books in the New Testament? Well,
they added it in 1546 officially to the canon of Scripture. And though Catholics today will say it's not true, it was never taken out. It was never added. It was always in. And that's not true. They don't know their history. So we got a break coming up, but I don't know the method that they did it to get it in, but I believe they did it in response to the Reformation, because the Roman Catholic Church is apostate and they wanted books to support their false doctrines, and that's why they included the Apocrypha. So hold on, man. We'll be right back after these messages. Please stay tuned. If you want to give me a call, 877-207-2276.
It's Matt Slick Live, taking your calls at 877-207-2276. Here's Matt Slick.
All right, everyone, welcome back to the show, and we'll get back to Dave here in a sec. As soon as he's activated, there we go. Dave, welcome back on the air.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, I do. I hear you, man. All right. So what do you got, man? What's up? Where were we?
Can you explain that last part? Because you was kind of cutting out with the commercial coming in.
What was the last part?
About, see, we're talking about the Apocrypha and the stance that Catholics use to try and support the, I guess, teaching from the Apocrypha.
Yes. So the Roman Catholic Church, I'm going to just say this publicly, is not a Christian church. It is an apostate false church, and it teaches a false gospel and promotes idolatry. And it's been doing this for centuries. And in its apostasy, where it has mingled the wisdom of man in its sacred tradition with the inspired word, whenever that is done, and everyone has the guts and the gall to mix them, it's always going to be the case that their traditions supersede the word of God. It's always going to be that case because they dare combine them. And so to do that is an arrogance and a foolishness. The Roman Catholic Church does this and promotes this. And so, in its arrogance and in its pride and in its apostasy, what it has done is authenticated certain aspects of the apocryphal books. And they did this in order, in my opinion, to bolster their false doctrines. They wanted to have scripture that supported their position. And so they added the apocryphal books. And the apocryphal books were not recognized by Jesus. They were rejected by the Jewish community, and they are not to be considered inspired. They have errors in them, and they're not to be trusted for that level of inspiration. Okay?
Okay. So, I mean, are they worth reading as far as for any kind of historical context or anything, sure. Or is it better just to avoid it altogether?
Sure, you know, for any kind of historical context, that is a wide open statement, so you have to say yes, because you can read them and just see what they say, but there are historical inaccuracies in there. I know of one, at least, and I think it has to do with Nebuchadnezzar. I'm looking through my notes to see where it is. But look at an article I wrote back in 2009. So, anyway... I do have here, let's see, on this one, that it says, it commands the use of magic in Tobit. Forgiveness of sins is by almsgiving in Tobit. And offering of money for the sins of the dead in Second Maccabees. And this is stuff that the Roman Catholic Church was kind of getting into and doing. So, of course, they're going to include that or try to include that in the Bible. It's a false religion. Okay. Yeah, here, I'm looking at some more stuff.
All right, well,
stuff.
I appreciate it.
Okay.
Sorry, that's short, but I got to get off of here. But I'll check out your articles on CARM and everything. So thank you for your help, and God bless you, sir.
You too, man. God bless. All right, looking at one of the articles I've written, this one was written back in 2018, Errors in the Apocrypha, Wrong Historical Facts, in Judith 1:5. It says, now in the 12th year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar, king of the Assyrians, who reigned in Nineveh, the great city. That was wrong. Baruch 6:2, when you came to Babylon, you shall be there many days and for a long time, even to seven generations. After that, I'll bring you away thence with peace. So it was such for 70 years, and it didn't happen. So there's just, or let's see, look, and yeah, there's some other issues here as well. But anyway, you can go check that. You can do a lot of research on that as well. I suggest that for people to do that. Let's get to Eileen from Toledo. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, it's Arlene.
Oh,
but
Arlene.
Anyway,
okay.
Hi there.
All right, so
yes.
It's all right.
No, everybody gets it wrong.
Okay.
I was wondering, I heard you say that the New American Standard Bible is probably the most accurate translation. And I have read it years and years ago, back in the 1970s and whatnot. I had one.
Mm-hmm.
However, I've noticed there are, of that translation, there are newer editions, and I wanted to get another New American Standard, but I didn't know if the newest one that was out was the best one to get. Because, you know, sometimes they kind of go along with the culture and some of these, how they translate.
Right.
So would the newest one be the best one, or would a previous translation of it, a previous year?
Yeah, the one I use is the NASB 95, 1995 edition. They have an edition of 2020, which I've really not gone through a lot. So I haven't been able to really examine it. I'm just so used to the 95 that I just, you know, I'm sticking with it, and I may move over to the 2020. But that's what I use, and I've been using it for a long time. So, you know, and it's a good translation. It's not perfect, but it's good, and it's more accurate to the Greek. Okay.
Okay. So you're using the 95, but you're saying maybe the 2020, you said?
Yes, I just haven't done a comparison yet. Yeah.
Ah, okay, because I was holding off on which year to buy, and I was just trending.
I had someone tell me that just what you were, your concern was, that it's a little bit more modified for contemporary usage. And had someone tell me that they compromised a couple places. And I said, I got to figure that out. But I've never gone in and looked. So I know the 95 is really steady. So that's where I'm at right now. So, and then, but you know, the 95 isn't perfect. It could be that the 20 fixes a few problems that 95 didn't quite get right. Because you can have emphasis of something. Now, I prefer literalness. So it might say, for all of man, pas anthropoi. And it you know, so it might say, all of men, when it means all mankind. But they might say, now, in the English, might say all people. Well, I get it. I get why they're saying something like that. But I prefer that they stick with the original, because I've learned that the pattern of original usage of words means something. And so I say, stick to it as literal as possible in the English and study it that way, and you'll learn things you won't learn any other way. Okay?
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Okay.
Good.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome so much. All right. You got any other questions?
Bye, Beck. No, that's all I had.
All right. Well, God bless.
You did well.
All right.
God bless you also.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Right. All right. Well, we have nobody waiting right now, so I think what I am going to do is go over to the radio questions folder and see what this was. See what this one. Who was King James? He was a king named James in England. That's about all I know of him. See, pretty, notice how incredibly intelligent that response was. Who was King James? I do that with my wife, you know, and I'll, you know, she might ask a question like, well, who is King James? And I'll look at her and she'll go, don't do it. Don't do it. And I'll just look at her with this face, little expression. She goes, you're going to say, she goes, don't tell me he's just a king. I said, well, he's a king named James. She goes, oh. So, you know, then she rubbed her forehead again. You know, she's having lots of headaches around me. I've noticed that. She rubbed her forehead a lot. And I was like, what, you know, maybe she needs some meds. I don't know. Something's up. So, here, let's see. That's interesting. Biblical thing of aliens. Let's see. You know, I'm just looking through some of the radio questions. We've got a few, but there, a lot of them are long. And like this one, reports a man saying Jesus after the murder. Okay, I don't know. Does God love equally? I already answered that. The answer is no. He does not love everybody equally. People are surprised by that. They'll say, no, he does. He loves everybody equally. No, he doesn't. See, in Psalm 5:5 and Psalm 11:5, I'm going to read this to you. Okay, this is God. So, Psalm 5:5, all right? The boastful shall not stand before your eyes. You hate all who do iniquity. And then in Psalm 11:5, the Lord tests the righteous and the wicked, and the one who loves violence, his soul hates. So there are biblical references where God hates people. And people are so shocked by that. That can't be true, because, you know, they had the image of the image of Jesus, who's the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Caucasian surfer dude dressed in a woman's nightgown, dressed to kill. And what he's doing is he's waiting for you to give him permission to let him into your heart. And, of course, that's just not going to work, you know. It's not going to work. It's just not the Jesus of the Bible. So Jesus did get upset with people. He called people whitewashed sepulchers. You're your father, the devil. I wouldn't call that exactly loving them. I'd call that judging them. So, no, Jesus doesn't love everybody equally. Okay? Or God doesn't either. All right, let me see. Get down to this. Matt, can you read this on air? If he so chooses. I'm writing. Oh, okay, never mind. Let's try this. I suppose a left and right thing is interesting symbolism. Never thought about that before. Left and right, probably in reference to the Day of Judgment. Because it doesn't say, I'm going to read down to the email here. Yes, okay, it is. So the criminals crucified on Jesus mocked him. The one on the right is saved, and the one on the left is not. On the Day of Judgment, the people on the right side, they are going to heaven. And the ones on the left are going to hell. A lot of people don't know that, okay? So I'm going to have to write an article on this. What is the significance of right and left in the Bible? So also, the disciples, when they were at the beginning of the ministry of Jesus, he went to the Sea of Galilee, and the disciples were casting their nets. They'd been out there all day, and they hadn't caught anything. And Jesus says, cast your net on the right side of the boat. Not the left, the right side. And they did, and they caught fish, which is just interesting. Also, check this out. If you go to John 21, and it says, and in John 21, and it says here, I'm going scanning through it, got out of the boat that night, they caught nothing. And in verse 4, but when the day was now breaking, Jesus stood on the beach. Yet the disciples did not know who it was. And he said, Jesus said to them, children, do you have any fish? They answered, no. He said, cast a net on the right-hand side of the boat, and you'll find a catch. So right there. So, and they did. And they caught so many that they couldn't bring it in. It was just so many. But it's interesting. It gives a number, 153. 153 fish were caught. Why? We got 15 seconds. I'm going to rush through this. Because the fish represent the people and none were lost. This is an indirect means of eternal security and demonstrating it, that none are lost whom God says to catch. And 153 individuals received a blessing from Jesus in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, all combined. Isn't that interesting? May the Lord bless you by His grace. Back on the air tomorrow, and hopefully we'll talk to you then. Have a great evening, everyone. God bless.